Good afternoon. So, last time, we talked a bit more about how we can use memory protection, this idea that we have this translation table the hardware uses anyways, and we have these permission bits where we can not only make it so that there's some region of memory where we can't access anything there, which we saw was useful for guard pages, but where we can make memory read-only or non-executable. So we could use this read-only idea, well, to make protect things that were common targets of attack. And one example was we had things like the global offset table with pointers to library functions. That was a nice, convenient thing to attack. We could just make that read-only. Now, there's some things where this doesn't work, and the big thing is where we have to modify it. And we saw that that was the reason why it wasn't read-only on Linux, apparently, is that because Linux was doing this lazy binding thing where it figured out where the library function is as you called it the first time, well, if it was doing that, it couldn't make that read-only, so it was writable. And similarly, this is why we can't apply this to our stacks, because we expect to write things to the stack where those return addresses are, even though we might prefer them to be read-only most of the time. We also talked about the idea of making things non-executable. And this was much more productive because it seemed like for most programs, well, we didn't really need to be able to both write and execute anything. That, you know, the stack, we are not going to execute code on it. And basically anything we can write to, we're not going to execute on it because we've already written all our machine code we intend to run in most programs, and we've loaded it from, you know, disk, basically. So after we load it from disk, we shouldn't need to write any executable stuff. And we could enforce this in our page tables. Mentioned that, well, you know, surprisingly, this took a while to happen, partly because the hardware support wasn't there. Hardware, you know, didn't prioritize making non-executable memory a thing for a while. They just said, well, if you can read it, why shouldn't you be able to execute it? They didn't think about these scenarios. And because there were some programs that, you know, even if they weren't something which would obviously take advantage of this, like something like a Java virtual machine, which is deliberately producing new code at runtime to be efficient, that there were still cases where programs deliberately wrote code at runtime and then tried to execute it. Now, once we had this write X or execute idea, it seemed like this kind of broke all our ideas about, well, how do we execute arbitrary code when a vuln gets exploited? And we have to rely on these kind of like special cases where the program just happens to do what we want without us needing to write new code. And we found out that, well, we don't really have to rely on a special case because the case where the program has the code we want as an attacker is pretty universal. And this is because we have these, what I call gadgets, these little snippets of code that we can chain together. Most commonly, we'll find snippets which end on a return, and we can arrange for, by manipulating the stack the program is using, the return to go to another snippet. We can piece these together into what we would call a return-oriented programming chain. And it just turns out that naturally, most programs have enough of these lying around that we can do pretty much anything we might care to do. And that means that, well, you know, we did make things harder with this write X or execute idea, but we didn't actually stop people from writing arbitrary code, essentially. This is not technically as flexible as being able to run shell code, but it turns out to be, you know, essentially the same in practice. So questions about things we covered last time before we finish up talking about a few miscellaneous things about return-oriented programming? Can I explain quiz question one? So quiz question one, I edited just before this lecture because it was read in the wrong, it could be read in two different ways, one of which wasn't what I intended. So I believe I've accepted more answers than were originally. But the intention was we have this buffer overflow where we can overwrite this current pointer. And my intention was to ask, what value should we put in the current pointer? The way I phrased this question, I think some people read it as what values would be useful somewhere in this exploit, which is not what I intended. So I've, in the last 5 minutes, modified it, last 15 minutes, modified it. So you should get credit for these answer A and B being selected too. But the idea is that we want to overwrite, as our sort of first step, a virtual table pointer or a pointer to a function directly. And that would be our first step. We wouldn't want to overwrite the buffer, which is what this is going to do. We wouldn't want to try to overwrite a library function's code. So this is assuming it's the value to place in current. But I realized, looking at, why did certain people select this, and looking at the comments, like, they're reading it as which of these values are useful in general, not just as a thing to put in as current. So, other questions? Can I explain how answer C works on question 4? Sure. So, answer C here. What we're going to do is we're going to first run this piece of code. So we're going to put, this is going to pop in order because we're pop increments the address. So we're going to jump to this 0x1000. It's going to pop RCX to get put 0 in RCX. It's going to put 4.2 in RAX and 4.3 in RDI. And then we're going to return to 1003. And that's going to move the value that was in RDI, which is the same as the value in EDI, to RSI or ESI, the aliases for the same thing, and the value in EAX to EDI, and then return to 0x2000, the actual function we want to run, after having set up ESI and EDI, which are the same as RDI and RSI. Does that answer the question? Or follow-ups. Okay, other questions? Did I record the lecture for the last class? Yes, and I will add a note to link that up. If ever it's not up the next day, please tell me, because that is a mistake. Okay, so on question 3, you thought even reading a guard page would cause an abort. Is that not true? So it is true that reading a guard page would cause an abort. What answer are you thinking would require reading a guard page? And this is for D. So a format string vulnerability, what we can do in that is we can say print out what's at this memory location, say as a string, for example. We can say there's a string at this memory location. So we could say, there's a string where current UI functions, the pointer is stored. And it will print out a string there. And we can even specify how long that string is. And so using that, we could print out the value without needing to access things that are around it in memory, by making one of the arguments to our printf call that we have a format string vulnerability for, be exactly where the pointer is and not something around it. So then question, could I set the value of scurrent to RSP and then buffer zero is the C standard lib function. So on question one, what I went over earlier is that I was trying to ask. I didn't end up asking it. So there's some extra credit here that's not mentioned here. What would be useful to put in S current specifically, not what would be useful overall in the exploit. But indeed, if you could make S current point to where the stack is, that would be a very useful value. And then putting, say, the address of the library function at the beginning of the buffer would be interesting. So, question: does the scurrent call not, how could this be used? So, if you made scurrent point to where this top of the stack, you could have a return address that you could overwrite using this. So, if you made scurrent point to a return address, that would be extremely useful. That wasn't one of these options, but if it was, it would be, should have been something you would have selected.
Then why would the address of hash buffers? Building without knowing the address of it.
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Yeah, so then why would A be useful for that type of exploit? Because couldn't you just fill in S buffer 0 without knowing the address of it?
So your question is, why wouldn't A be useful? So I intended to ask, what would be useful to put in S current? That was the intention of the sentence before. And you wouldn't put put the address of S buffer 0 in S current, because then this would end up just overwriting part of the buffer.
Right.
With a copy of itself.
No, I was saying for the second exploit. So for the one that you didn't intend for the question to be regarding, the one where you set the S current to like RSP and then point to the C standard library, why would the S buffer 0 address be useful? Because wouldn't you just be overwriting S buffer without actually caring what the
address is? The question is why S buffer 0 would be useful. So it would be for a different type of scenario. Sorry. So S buffer 0 would be if you wanted to, for example, if you wanted to put shellcode in the buffer, having this address would be useful for other parts of the exploit.
Gotcha.
Which is why, in the general, would it be useful? And if for an exploit overall, I would say, yeah, it would be useful to know what this is. But, okay. Does that answer that question? Because the thing is, they're like, there's a whole bunch of ways you could take advantage of this. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's... So let's keep move on. And first, I'm going to do an interlude on Obfuscate. I know it's been a while, but I needed to wait until after the final late deadline and other people with extensions. So this assignment is new, as you may or may not have noticed. It was based on an assignment by Davidson when he taught this class last, but he did something very different with Tigris. And someone discovered a correct, great, and unintended solution, which is that everything, the comparison for the password used memcomp. So the password check was implemented by hashing the password and doing a memcomp to compare the hash with the expected value. And there wasn't much else that used memcomp, which meant that a valid strategy that one person figured out that I didn't anticipate is just replace the memcomp call, and it works for all the versions. So great, great work. That's wasn't an intended solution, but it's certainly within the spirit of sort of the assignment, which is pointing out that, well, you know, if your task isn't to like rewrite the whole program as readable code, you know, if you want to do some specific thing, you can do that. And for analyzing malware, that's a very useful thing, because like if you want to like figure out what files is this malware looking for, things like that, you know, you can do that without actually figuring out everything about the malware. Also, so I think most people had solutions for the assignment, but few problems. And the biggest problem, I think, was TTT3, so that's worth going over what I did there, especially since some of you may have done things where you felt, like, very unsatisfied. So what I did is I did some find replaces. So I noticed, oh, there's this thing that looks like the program counter in that pattern I saw. So I just find replaced it everywhere so I could actually, like, kind of read through this code. And I added my debug print here, and this is what I debug printed, is the address of where in the code array this PC value was. And I figured out which one of this operation here, which looked like a branch. How did I know it looked like a branch? Well, because it was the place where I found, oh, there's a conditional assignment to the program counter value in the interpreter that they had for their kind of virtual machine interface. And I said, well, I know the one at this particular offset is the one that does the wrong thing, so I just flipped it. Questions on Obfuscate? When can we expect grades for this in Lex? Lex, did I not post Lex grades? I thought I posted Lex grades. Apparently I did not post all the Lex grades. Why do I have unposted Lex grades? Is it because I'm... Okay. Oh, no, I guess I still have... Okay. Hopefully very soon. I guess we do have some ungraded Lex cases. I'll need to investigate. I thought I had more Lex grades posted than I did. But very soon. Lex, I think, is almost graded. But the grades might not be almost graded, so that I should have that done soon. Obfuscate, we have to do some reading to grade. Okay. Other questions? So I believe when we finished up last time, we mentioned that you could use ROP for cases where we didn't have a Stack Overflow. So returning programming, it seems like, well, the natural way to use it was overwriting a return address, and then we just have our chain of things after that for more return addresses. But we don't need that. We can instead look for a gadget that sets the stack pointer and kind of use that to set up this return-oriented programming chain. So, for example, in mylibc, here are two gadgets that actually exist. So there's we have this, say, push RDI and call something, and this pop and return. So... Oh, this doesn't work, does it? And I wrote an example that doesn't actually work. So the version which would work would be... This should be jump. Oh, yeah, this doesn't work because it probably... The example which would work is this is a jump. So... So if this is a jump and not a call, then what this would do is it pushes a value. So let's say argument 1, and then goes to 3. So if we set argument 3 to point to the second gadget, then the second gadget's going to pop our argument 1 and set that as the new stack pointer. So this is something we can chain together to get a new stack pointer value. So we look for sets of gadgets like this. If we had a call here, we'd need to have something extra pushed on the stack first, which we could probably, so we'd need something like, or so we need to have something extra popped on the stack here. So we need something that pops something else and then pops RSP. But we can look for things like this, which just occur again the same way other gadgets occur, that, you know, there's some random bytes just turn into it, happen to match up with a pop instruction. And we can look for that. So as an example of this, you know, let's think about sort of a practical case where we have, say, a buffer next to an object with a vtable. And we want to take advantage of an overflow on this buffer to actually make, you know, some code of our choice run. And there's going to be this sort of method call here. And, well, the way that method call is implemented is by looking up in this vtable pointer that is contained within foo the actual address of the method. So our goal is going to be to replace that with something that will start in ROP chain. So an example of what we might do is we can overflow the buffer and try to make, in this example, we'll have foo will point to the beginning of the buffer. We'll make sure the end of the buffer has the address of the beginning. If we didn't know the address of the buffer, maybe there's some other thing we know the address of we could point to that we control, like a global variable or something like that. And, you know, at the beginning of this buffer would be our vtable pointer. This is not the real vtable pointer, but this is going to be our substitute for it because we follow pointers in the same way that we would have normally. So we're going to arrange for that vtable pointer to, you know, have at the offset that this method name here would be the same distance pointer to the first gadget we want to run. And we're just going to choose some gadget that we find that's going to end up, you know, letting us set the stack pointer. And we might look for, you know, some sequence that does this, but whatever that first gadget would be sort of how we'd end up getting control. So for example, maybe our first gadget, you know, maybe it's going to be a multi-step process. But in this case, as often happens when we have this sort of thing, we can also end up controlling some of the arguments to this, you know, gadget, which means we control the values of certain registers. So in this case, X and Y and foo are the arguments. So we can control X, RSI, and Y, RDX. So we can have a gadget here which, say, pushes the value of RDX on the stack and jumps to a value address we specify in RSI. And if RSI, say, points to that gadget we showed earlier, that pop RSP pop RSP ret, that would be enough for us to set the stack pointer. So question is, why is foo an argument here? So if we're calling a method, there needs to be access to in C++ would be the this pointer. The most common way that's implemented is by passing it as an argument, even though you don't specify it explicitly. Other questions? So this work I'm doing to set up sort of return-oriented programming, where I, you know, have these gadgets which don't end in returns, and I use them to change the stack pointer so I can start using those convenient gadgets to end the return, show that, well, the return wasn't actually mandatory. So we can do what's sometimes called jump-oriented programming, that you can, instead of trying to chain together gadgets that end in return, you can chain together gadgets that end in caller jumps. There's less of these. They're harder to find, harder to systematically chain together than the return-oriented things. But in a large program, it seems likely that they'll have the same sort of power as return-oriented gadgets. That if you do enough work, you can do all the things you can do with the return-based gadgets with these caller jump-based gadgets. And as for intuition for why this might happen, you know, because it's not intuitive, because like with these return-oriented gadgets, we can kind of like write a program where our program is just in sort of this weird language where it's just a list of values we put on the stack, you know, where the values either represent a gadget that's an instruction in this weird programming language, or some data for one of the gadgets that's going to pop off the stack. It seems like we don't have that sort of, you know, nice structure here, but it can kind of happen by accident when we find what sort of the seminal work on jump-oriented programming calls a dispatcher gadget. So this is an example of sort of what might be a dispatcher gadget. Here we add to a pointer that would be an RCX, and jump based on what that points to. And sort of a way we can end up using this is by having sort of a list of the gadgets we want to run, the same sort of thing we have in our return-oriented programming. And if we, you know, keep jumping back to this dispatcher gadget, so if our other gadgets, say, end with a jump to RDX or RDI, and we set up RDX and RDI by, you know, controlling some arguments to the function that sets this whole thing up, we can end up having them go back to this gadget dispatcher, and we can basically write our program as this big array of gadget addresses. And, you know, depending on exactly what our dispatcher gadget looks like and what else we have, you know, this might take a little work to set up, but we can basically do the same kind of programming you'd imagine with return-oriented programming without returns. And you might say, so why is this sort of notable? Well, this is because, you know, a natural thing people said when they got to be told about how powerful return-oriented programming is, well, let's just get rid of these unprotected returns in the machine code. And this demonstrates that, well, that's not quite enough. Now, when I say, you got awful lucky here. This dispatcher thing here, that's not realistic. And so, you know, indeed, usually we're not going to find something that's this nice, but we'll often find things that are close. So for an example, you know, if I look at some big applications like libc or Firefox, these are the sorts of things we might try to use as dispatcher gadgets, you know, where it's not so clean, like, in these two cases were, Intel syntax. So in this case, we add a register value to another register and then use that register in some way to jump. We have to do some offsetting, and we have to manage to set up this offset here to do that. And we might have some other indirection similarly So it might not be so quite so straightforward. It might not look like an array like this. It might have to be offset in a different way. We might have to have some pointers to pointers to make it work. But there are things we can find which achieve this sort of effect, where we can have this loop where through the loop we read different parts of instructions, basically, and set up whatever we want to run. So questions about this dispatcher idea? Okay. Now, most commonly, the design that you'll see chosen in practice is that we'll look for a gadget that lets us stack the stack pointer. So here I have an example of a buffer overflow. Here we have a vulnerable structure with a pointer to a function. And what I do is I read into that buffer, overflowing this pointer, and then we scan the input. So we expect the input to be a string. Fortunately, scanf, when it, runs out of things that match, it just stops. So we scan for a number as a desk number. So like the expected input is like 15 foo to pass 15 here and foo here. And then we call this function pointer. So given that, so if we have the address of this gadget as process function, what do we want to put at the beginning of name, or sort of input? Okay, there's less consensus on the answer than I would like so far, so that's interesting. You have another 10 seconds or so. Okay. So, let's think about what goes on here. So, if we set process function to point to this code, the first thing it's going to do is, remember AT&T syntax, so the sets RSP, is that it's going to change the stack pointer. So we have our old stack, we call process function, that pushes a return address, I'll make in green on the stack, and at this point here, that's where we're running this code. Then it changes the stack to point to somewhere else. So by the time we get to the return, we have a new stack. And we're going to pop something off it to return. There, at the new stack. And where is the new stack? And this is located where RSI was. So it's going to be equal to this RSI argument. So note that we're popping an address off the stack because that's what a return does. So we can't just put an index the address of an existing function because we're going to look at that address for another address. So that doesn't quite work. If there's an existing function we can run, we want not the address of the existing function, but an address of a pointer to it. And that pointer to the existing code to run is going to be our ROP chain. And that's because, yeah, when we set the stack, we're going to pop with return from where the stack was set to. The stack itself, the stack pointer itself, is not where the code we're going to run is. Okay, so we pop 8 bytes from address 15. So if our input is 15 comma foo, we'd pop 8 bytes from address 15. That would not be the input we want to set because almost certainly address 15 is invalid. And when I say our input is 15 foo, I mean our input is 15 foo plus a bunch of stuff that eventually overwrites process function. So like our actual exploit here is going to look like some 8 NORD and the, so we're going to have at the beginning in decimal the address of the ROP chain we've set up somehow earlier. Maybe there we put it, have a value and it's stored in a global variable that's this or something like that. And at the part of the buffer that's going to overwrite process function, we'll have in binary the address of this gadget. And that would be what our input is. Some questions about this setup? So let's do a different version. So let's say this is what we overwrite process function with. What would the answer then be? Give another 10 seconds or so. Okay, we definitely do not have consensus here. So something worth noting is that RSI here, that string, that integer we're parsing from the beginning input, isn't actually used here. So these last three answers seem unlikely that this written out in decimal part is going to work out. Because, well, yes, we're decoding it in decimal, but that value isn't actually used by this gadget. So it's probably not relevant. So instead, we're going to somehow, you know, use name and RDI, which is a pointer to the beginning of the buffer, as what happens. So this jumps to not the beginning of, oh, so actually, inadvertently, I should have had a different option. So the answer we really wanted is the address of the shell code. It's C prime, which wasn't an option, in binary, or existing function, in binary. So decimal doesn't quite work, but other than that, that this idea is right, or if it's not in decimal, if it's in binary, E is right. E is fine. Why is E interesting? Because we can push a value, an address, on the stack with of name and then return to there if we jump to a return instruction. So yeah, so sorry, I should have thought, realized, I think I was misremembering this. I added this in decimal thing later and misremembered that for this version of the question, it's not really something I wanted. But the way option C would work is that we'd read the beginning of input as an address, because this is kind of a double dereference, and jump there. So it would be C, but in binary. And the way this option would work, E would work, is that we'd read RDX, the address of name, as a place to, as where our code is, and we'd jump there with this return instruction. So, questions about, a question is, why did I not select D? So that's a good question. So remember that our ROP chains, this needs to be the contents of the stack. And we don't have a way with this of setting the contents of the stack yet. We would need probably to find some existing code that did that. Then we could use a standard ROP chain. And that's also the problem with sort of B, right? That we need the ROP chain is something to put on the stack. We aren't setting the stack here. So we need an extra step to be able to do that. Does that clarify things? But I probably should have spent more time emphasizing that, because yes, indeed, B and D were the most popular answers. So yeah, the big problem is that the ROP chain is something we want on the stack, and we haven't found the step here yet of actually changing where the stack pointer is. Okay, Follow-ups? Other questions? So, can I explain what this jump instruction does? So this jump instruction, so let's say RDI contains 0x1000 and memory at 0x1000 contains 0x2000. In that case, this jump instruction would go to 0x2000. That would be where the next code we run is. And a question about, so I was talking about jumping to RDI, which is E, and it's not obvious how, immediately that's part of our input. The reason why it's part of our input is because it's the first thing in the example struct. So E input has the same address as E. So we've looked a bunch at this return-oriented programming and sort of the alternative of jump-oriented programming. And one thing people thought about a lot is, well, let's just get rid of these gadgets. There shouldn't be these handy little snippets of code lying around our programs. And these just exist because we have these jumps and returns where we don't do some sort of check beforehand. So let's add some sort of check for them. So, for example, this 2010 paper called G-Free tried to do this, and it's quite illustrative of, that yes, you could do this, and no, you're probably not going to convince people to do it. So, how did they do it? Well, first, they got rid of unintended jump and return instructions. So, you remember how we saw, returns in the middle of other instructions? They carefully rewrote those instructions in other ways to avoid that. I'll give some examples of how in a second. And they added some stack canary-like checks to jump and return instructions. So rather than just having a jump star RDI, they would have a canary check before it. So you couldn't make a useful gadget out of it. And they did also have stack canaries-like things for returns. And the hope is that, well, they didn't actually get rid of all the gadgets, but the hope is that because all the gadgets you'd find would have these stack canary-like checks, they'd all be useless unless you had a very good information leak to get that secret value, which would be a big improvement. And the preview of why don't we do this is, well, they managed, and their time overhead for the benchmarks they ran, which maybe would be not the worst case here, but, cases they came up with was 0 to 6%. So 6% is actually a lot to ask for people. People are not happy if they're like an OS maker to say, my new OS is going to run things 6% slower. But it's in the range where you might get away with it if your protection's good enough. But they had 20 to 30% space overhead. The executables were 20 to 30% bigger. And we can see why when we look at how they dealt with this first part here. How did we get rid of these unintended jump and returns? So, here's an example of a transformation they did. So this add instruction in its encoding, because of this constant OXC2, well, that actually turns into a variation on the return instruction because C2 is the opcode for another version of the return instruction. So their fix was to change the constant and add an extra instruction to deal with that. And they just had a whole bunch of rules like this. Another thing they did is they dealt with cases where you had a return instruction that was kind of only was part of an instruction because of we had this sort of mixing of two instructions, that we have this gadget here where we had these two innocent instructions So a move and a rotate left. This is a bit manipulation instruction, which could also be interpreted as an add followed by a rep. And the problem is that our rotate left instruction in its register encoding uses the bytes for return. And their fix for this was that they'd add a bunch of nops so that if you had a gadget here, you could either get the return instruction alone, the rotate left instruction, or some nops before the rotate left instruction. You couldn't get this mixed version. So a question is, wouldn't this cause significantly slower compile times? So I think the transformation was relatively fast. The way it worked is by actually taking the assembly and turning it into new assembly. But, you know, the compile times, I don't think were the biggest concern. Especially because when we talk about overhead numbers, you could probably, people are probably more willing to tolerate like a 10 or 20 or 30% increase in compile time than they are to tolerate a 5% time slowdown. Questions about this idea of removing gadgets. Okay, so as we've kind of previewed earlier in the semester, the real solution that we have to gadgets is address space layout randomization. That's our primary defense. It's not perfect because we kind of assuming that addresses don't leak. But the hope is that it prevents us from actually, you know, writing out return-oriented programming chains because we can't know what the addresses of the gadgets are. It prevents us from overwriting global offset table pointers because we don't know where the global offset table is, assuming we don't have an information leak. So we're going to talk a bit about how address space layout randomization sort of works out and exactly how difficult is it really to attack. So Linux, how does Linux do address space layout randomization? So give an example starting with the stack. So we saw that the stack was randomized, and what Linux does is it chooses a number in this range and then starts the stack at a fixed location minus that number times 0x1000. So what's this? This is 4K pages. So the stack always starts at the beginning of a page because remember, we manage our memory in these whole page units. So for that reason, even though we have this 16 gigabyte range here, it's going to be the case that the stack is at the beginning of a page. So we don't have 16 billion possibilities. We have 16 billion divided by 4K possibilities. And, well, this number is still very large, and that's great. But we're going to see when we talk about, say, 32-bit, that this becomes a problem. And to note that, like, even though we have a huge number of addresses, you know, that we manage our memory in these sort of page units is going to be a bit limiting for how much we can randomize. And Linux makes similar decisions for other regions of memory. So the sort of basic process layout in 64-bit x86 Linux is we have our stack and we have this several gigabyte, 16 gigabyte range of where it can start. Again, we don't choose from all the possible addresses, only page align ones. We have a similar ID range of a bigger size where we load dynamically linked libraries, and a similar idea about where we put the beginning of the heap. And then we have sort of our standard locations for code and writable data. Here I'm giving it This is with randomization turned off. Off. If it's on, we're going to put it, it's going to be treated like probably like dynamic code and be loaded in this area up top here. And this is, sorry, I should not say with randomization off. I say this is, you know, if program compiled with fixed addresses. And up here is if program is compiled without fixed addresses. Okay. So this is 64-bit Linux. 32-bit, well, they just had less room to work with. So yeah, the stack location's randomized, but this is a much smaller range. And same for the library locations and the heap locations, but it's just a much smaller range. And remember that this is always going to be aligned to a page. So this gives us hex 800 possibilities, and this gives us hex 80 possibilities, or sorry, times 2 possibilities. So there's a lot fewer possibilities. And usually the way we think about this is sort of how many random bits there are to, you know, choose the address, because we can think about that in terms of guessing. So for 64 bits, for as a summary, like it actually how much random choice there is depends on which region we're talking about. But there's around 30 bits that are randomized in the address, which means we need to guess 30 bits of the address if we're just guessing. If we don't have an information leak, that's what we're going to have to work with. So that means that we're going to need about 2 to the 30 guesses before we'd get it right by just guessing. With 32-bit, some parts of the address will have about 8 random bits. So that's only about 2 to the 8 guesses. And this is where, you know, we ran into problems. And one reason why in the early days, when 32-bit systems were a lot more common, address-based layout randomization seemed a lot less effective. If you have only need 2 to the 8 guesses, then, well, 1 out of 256 times you get it right. And the reason why they were so constrained is that if you want to make it a wider range, you need to have more space to give, you know, because we have these gaps here, which allow us to have this variation, you know, and you want to still have them so your programs can like allocate a gig of space. But this is 1 and 256. Well, if we think about like a server that restarts itself, well, we can try 256 times pretty practically. 1 and 2 to the 30, we probably can't do. We probably can't work by guessing. And in practice, it's pretty often that we can get multiple guesses in. Things might not crash, or it might not crash the whole application. Like we might have a server with multiple processes that are independent, but we're all loaded in the same way. Or if it's a local bug, like if it's some privileged program we can run locally, like on, say, a department server, like if that was something we were worried about, you know, a malicious student exploiting a mission program there, they could maybe be able to just run the program whenever they want. Or you might have like a server that does crash, but, well, what do people want to do to their web server when it crashes? Restart it. And they probably want to automate that sort of thing. So quite often in practice, even though it might seem like, you know, well, if we guess we're going to get it wrong, that might be fine. The attacker might be perfectly willing to crash your server 200 times if on the 201st time they get to run their code. And if you're automatically restarting your server, you might not even notice, unless you're like looking for that. So another thing that's notable about this strategy is that we're kind of keeping the different regions together. And if we think about say, an application here, which can be loaded at arbitrary addresses, so which will, on our 64-bit system, will end up being loaded up here. We look at the executable file, we have these four different load directives. And you might say, okay, there's four separate things to load, so we choose a random address four times. But that's not something we can do. And, oh, I misformatted this. So, and as an example of why that isn't something we can do, well, we have a dependency here from an instruction that's loaded by the second load to an address in the global offset table that's loaded by the fourth load. So we have a dependency between these two loads that's based on a fixed offset. So when producing this executable, the linker assumed that even though these are independent loads, they're all going to be loaded together, and that, you know, and that, for example, the second loaded thing is going to be at a fixed offset, which is equal to this difference here from the fourth loaded thing. That if we're loading the first thing at 0x, you know, 1000, then the second thing is going to be at the second thing is at 0x1000, and the fourth thing is going to be at 0x1000 plus 2db8, because that's the difference between these two virtual addresses. So basically, because of these sorts of dependencies, we're going to be required to keep all these segments together. And this is a choice that Linux made. Linux just said, I don't want to edit the code when I'm loading programs. So I don't want to have to like edit our references to variables or our references to the global offset table as part of loading the program, because that makes it a lot faster. Also, perhaps more importantly, allows the same code, especially for things like the C standard library, to be loaded in multiple programs, because those relative references are all going to be the same in every single program, even if, say, the C library is at a different location in each program. But this means that leaking pointers is maybe more dangerous than it might appear, because if I get any stack pointer, well, I know where everything is on the stack. I can kind of compute it relatively, and we've seen that already. But the same is going to be true with an executables or libraries. If I get any pointer in my executable, all of a sudden, I know the addresses of everything else in the executable. So like if I get a global variable in the executable, I can now use that to figure out where all those gadgets I might use for return-oriented programming are in the executable. And so this means that address space layout randomization, is not maybe as, hard for the attacker to deal with as we might think, in that, we don't have to find a specific leak that exactly matches what we're looking for. Yeah, we're basically looking for a leak of anything in the executable or anything in a library, and that's going to be good enough. So sort of as an example of this, so let's go here. So this code, leak something. So what value is most likely to be leaked by this code here, where we get a pointer foo to f to an object foo, and we print it out with percent s. give another 20 seconds. Okay, so the majority answer is A, and this is not quite right. So this would be the right answer if the printf looked something like, was say, percent D. But it's percent S. So what printf is thinking we're doing is that we'd like to be passing a string through a pointer to a character. So we're not printing out the actual address of the string, well, in this case where it prints out hello, we're printing out the characters that P points to. So here we're going to print out the beginning of foo, whatever's at the beginning of foo in memory, as characters. And we'll hopefully be able to figure out what those characters correspond to and what they actually represent. And most likely what they actually represent is the V table pointer. So foo most likely has a V table that points to, say, the address of foo bar is inside there. So most likely we're getting the address of the V table pointer, which is the thing that's stored at the beginning of the object foo, but not the address of foo itself. Beginning of the object f, but not the address of f itself. So questions about how I figured that out? So the question is, why is it the first entry in the vtable and not the vtable pointer? So is the same as the address of the V table. Because a pointer to the V table is a pointer to the beginning of the V table. Just like a pointer to an array, or the address of an array, is a pointer to the first thing in the array. Does that answer the question of why I didn't write why these are equivalent? So another question, why doesn't ASLR break fixed addresses? So ASLR does break having hard-coded addresses in programs. And as we'll talk about a bit later, you know, this means that we're going to might have to do some extra work to get rid of them when we're compiling, which is why full ASLR wasn't used in the early days. Another big reason, besides the sort of 32-bit version of it maybe not being so great. But now that we know that this value is leaked, let's think about the sort of second part here. Well, we know the vtable, you know, address was leaked. What could we compute based on that? Oh. And I guess I didn't leave. So we've learned that this printed out, you know, this value is what this guy gave us. It was actually written as a string, but yeah, we figured out it represented this pointer, which was our, you know, vtable first entry address. So vtable address. Thank you. Give another 20 seconds or so. So one kind of hint from the values we've seen in the debugger is that we have these kind of clusters of values, which, you know, just happen naturally because they're allocated from the same sort of source. And so the way I like thinking about this is that, well, we have a region of memory for our stack, and our stack has to stay together because we push and pop and add and subtract to get to other things in the stack. We have our libc and our main, and these are loaded together because that shouldn't we have a bunch of load instructions for the different direct segments in the object file or the library or the executable, but they're all loaded together because they relatively address each other. So we have the stuff that was loaded for our main executable and the stuff that's loaded in C, and these were two different sort of distinct chunks. And everything that's from the main executable is going to be together. Everything that's from libc is going to be together. And then we have the heap, which is, again, set up at runtime. And the address we found here was, when we were debugging, was this address. And we know that this vtable was this distance from foobar. And probably what this vtable is, this is probably a constant in main.exe. A constant, struct in main.exe. So it's basically a global variable in main.exe. And also in main.exe is the code probably is in for foobar, is probably in main.exe too, alongside it. And our gadget address, especially since it has such a related address, like it's in between these two things, and this is a relatively small distance, probably is also in main.exe. So we probably know all of these. And how would we compute them? Well, we'd say, it's the vtable, foobar is, minus 3,000 to get to there. So we probably just subtract 0x3000 to get our foobar address in the executable as it was running with this randomization. And we can similarly subtract the distance to this gadget to get the address of that gadget when it's running with this randomization. So questions about how I figured that out? I see that I'm... So the question is, why is this a constant struct? So if we think about how the vtable is implemented, there's going to be basically a struct foo vtable, where we've just set it up to have the foo bar implementation as its values. This is going to be a global variable that's initialized by the compiler. And the reason it would all be together with main.exe is that we know that the things in main have references to their constant data via things like via relative addressing. That when we say load the address of a global variable, it's going to be done with this relative addressing because the linker doesn't want to edit the code when it loads the program. So even though main is going to have multiple segments, it might be clearer. So we're going to have like the executable part and the constants part, even though these might be separated, these are going to have to be loaded together because the executable part has sort of a constant offsets inside it to figure out to load its constants. Okay. Other questions before I sign off, because I'm definitely over time? And I will make sure Lex grades are posted. I thought that was already done.
I just had a quick question. Aren't the constants stored at the bottom and not in main exe specifically?
So the constants would be like this region of memory here. And they're going to be loaded with main. They're going to be loaded as a separate segment, but because main refers to those constants with those relative addressing, they have to be a fixed distance from the main's code.
Okay, so they're randomized, but not with respect to each other. So
yes.
They're both randomized, like, together?
We choose a random location for everything from main.exe. The constants and everything else. But, yeah, they're kept together.
That makes sense. And then one other question. On the homework, I didn't know if there was another way, but I basically left the, like, most significant byte of the... I forget if it was a return address, but I left like the most significant byte, I think, of a pointer. Is that fine? Because it wasn't used anyways. Like, it was only using the lower bytes. It was like 40 something.
So
and you couldn't the backslash n in otherwise without overflowing.
So it's pretty normal not. So in little endian systems, it's pretty normal to be able to overwrite a pointer without overwriting the whole thing if you don't need to change the upper bits. And that's
okay. I was just wondering.
That's common.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So, how would you do this in practice if you're like trying to compute the offset? So you use like a debugger in one setting to find out kind of how they're related, and then you'd use like an actual, I guess, runtime to find out what that new offset would be.
So that would be So an example, would be you run the program with a debugger to figure out how they're related, and you just adjust the offset accordingly. You can also, like, often compute the offset directly by, like, saying, oh, I know how far apart these things are because the code says so. Like, there's this instruction which says this offset.
Gotcha. And then, so, this is kind of a more general question and also relates to, like, the jump-oriented programming as well. So, like, there's all these protections put in place, like the kind of different canaries and they're taking out all of the jump and returns.
Yeah.
What kind of systems are they trying to get into? Because I'm assuming, like, it's not something they download onto their own computer and then try to break the executable. It's, like, where are these stored?
What do you mean? So, I don't get... So, your question is about this scenario of...
Yeah, and kind of in general, like when we're doing these exploits, like on our own, we're really only accessing our own computer's information, I guess. So where are these like executables stored that they'd be trying to break into it?
So a common example would be like if someone is running a web server, you can probably obtain a copy of that web server yourself, right? The same program. And in that case, it might be the case that you could exploit the web server over the internet. Giving inputs. And because like it's pretty common for people not to recompile everything themselves, or if they do, like they're compiling it in the exact same way that, you know, the standard instructions would say to, you can eat pretty easily get a copy of that binary. And if you can't, so the same sort of information leaks we talked about can also leak machine code.
Oh, interesting. I see.
So you could potentially, like, I'm not sure this has really been done, but like, at least in theory, like it's basically as bad because, you know, you can try to like read out the machine code from that, from an information leak. If you like figure out there's a pointer overwrite that then outputs what's at that pointer, you know, you could just systematically read the program's machine code.
Gotcha. Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, well, just one quick question. Could you explain the struct vtable thing again? I didn't understand that.
Struct vtable. So we're going to have... Oh, so if we think about, so, but if we think about what this, how this V table is declared, so basically foo's constructor, when we make a foo object, we're going to do run this, this new is going to do F V table equals a constant, right?
Yeah.
And this constant is going to be a struct that's pre-declared by the compiler, which is filled in with the addresses we want, including the address of, like, foobar.
Okay, and why is that placed in main?
So it's going to be part of the main executable if foo is part of the main executable. So, sorry, I meant, like, main.exe. I probably should have used a different name. But the main executable, the executable that we're loading, if it contains the code for foobar, it probably contains the code for the code that, like, has this virtual table set up.
Okay, I think that makes sense. And the virtual table's made at compile time?
Yeah. And when we have this address space layout randomization, it has to actually be filled in at runtime because the addresses in it aren't constant. But this is one of the things the linker will do as part of loading the program.
Okay. And it's not defined by a subclass, right? It's just defined in that struct? Or is a subclass making a function that's put in that constant struct?
What's not defined by a subclass? So in this case, there's no subclass. But because it's virtual, we have to lay it out as if this F might end up pointing to a subclass.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.